Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. This podcast is brought to you in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. I'm Owen Dorr, I'm one of your co-hosts, I'm an anaesthetic registrar working in Thames Valley, and with me today is Duncan Kemp as a fellow co-host who is working as an anaesthetic registrar in London. And today we are joined by Dr. Helgi Johansson, who is an anaesthetic consultant and also former Royal College Vice President. And we are going to tackle the topic of obstetrics beyond the IACOA, the top tips. And we're going to cover many topics. We're going to go into what makes Obs Marmite and great to work in, some tips and tricks for mastering epidurals. We'll talk about the importance of communication on labour wards, and then discuss some future developments as obstetric anaesthetists on labour wards. As you can tell, that is a lot of ground to cover, and we thank Helgi for joining us with such good humour that allowed this to be a very easy conversation. As ever, as a disclaimer, the opinions of Duncan, myself, or Helgi's are that of our own and don't necessarily reflect that of the institutions that we've partnered with for this podcast. With that disclaimer out of the way, we'll move on to the episode, where we'll start with the topic of the importance of music on labour wards. Now onto our obstetric theme. Duncan and I are collating a playlist. It may or may not be called C-section Perfection.
Brilliant.
An amalgamation of various different musical tastes. If you were to put one or two songs onto that playlist for an obstetric C-section or epidural placement, what would they be?
Ooh, before I answer that question, can I give you a bit of background?
Yeah,
of course. So I use music routinely in my clinical practice, both in obstetrics and non-obstetrics. Yeah. And I think it's a really important and a great way both of establishing a connection between you and your patient, but also to make your patient feel at ease and to give them something else to concentrate on, something else to think about than the suction sound or the clumping of the scrub nurses putting out all the equipment and things like that. And I think we forget how intimidating it is to be lying flat on your back, looking up at everyone. And so anything that you can do to relax them or burst the tension bubble a little bit works quite well. So I usually come to an agreement with my patient about what music to play. But for cesarean sections, I think the most fun I have with the music is when I play a playlist on Spotify called Cheesy Hits.
Okay.
And I have it on random. And the best song that came out when the baby came out was I Want to Break Free. So, and there was a bit of tension in the room at the time, but it just completely dissipated the tension. And there was a lot of humour that this song came on just randomly, just as this baby was being born.
That's excellent.
And everyone loved it. Who knows? Maybe the baby got called Freddy.
That would be quite funny.
It might have come out with a moustache as well. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
We're not down dealing with that, are we? We're too busy working out which uterotonic to give at the time.
Exactly. And I think that's something with obstetrics where it's so important that we make our kind of routine automatic so that we've actually got headspace to do all the soft stuff around the corners. And that's what comes with experience in obstetric anaesthesia. It becomes so routine to give the carbetocin after delivery, to give the antibiotics at the point where you give the antibiotics, et cetera, that you've actually got the bandwidth to be interacting with the patient and yet still be checking that the obstetricians are doing a good job and that there isn't major bleeding, that the uterus is contracting and that all these other things are going well. And it becomes a pattern recognition thing.
Yeah, you're almost aiming for the opposite of task fixation, aren't you? You're rapid task switching. You're in that flow state of, are you okay? Yes. Peeking over the curtain, having a little look, so you check the obs, make sure that everyone's calm, make sure that the partner's not about to swoon and fall over with either stress or feeling lightheaded from seeing a small needle.
Absolutely.
Okay. Going back onto your music point for, firstly, either creating normalization or creating a friendly environment for them, it's so important. And it might be seen as a soft skill, but
My experience is I've had multiple MRIs, and sitting there for 45 minutes makes it go so much easier when there is some music going. Mm. What I'd love to do is a randomised controlled trial as to whether or not listening to Fleetwood Mac decreases their anxiety. Mainly Fleetwood Mac, so I can get Fleetwood Mac into the literature. Which
yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good shout, Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong. There's a study that a very keen regional anaesthetic consultant told me about, which was apparently if you play someone's favoured music whilst doing a block, it has the equivalent relaxation and positive patient feedback as giving them some Midazolam, which is impressive, isn't it?
It doesn't surprise me at all. It just relaxes somebody.
Yeah.
And it gives a degree of familiarity to an unfamiliar surrounding.
Aside from being able to play cheesy hits, what is it you like about obstetric anaesthesia? What is it that potentially drew you to it in the first place or makes you enjoy doing it?
So I started obstetrics, I suppose, at UCL when I was an SHO. I did, and it was called SHO then. I suppose I should translate it into CT2, I suppose.
Yeah.
Something that struck me, one of the consultants there called Wynne Davis, who some people might know, who are listening to this, an absolutely awesome consultant. He was doing a cesarean section, and he had a great rapport with the woman. It made me just think how important our communication skills are and our soft skills, and how we are in an absolutely unique position where we can influence a really important part in somebody's life, the birth of their child, and make it a really positive experience. And I wanted that. And also I love doing epidurals. Epidurals are my favourite procedure. They are such fun.
Very satisfying.
They are. They're so satisfying. Being able to go into a room where you've got somebody in absolute agony, and then 5 minutes later, they think you're wonderful. You can't get more instant gratification than that.
Definitely one of the ultimate procedural challenges. And then when you're up the learning curve, and then the satisfaction afterwards of, you know, like you said, they're suddenly thanking you, thinking you're superhuman, and then often having a nap.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was trying to work out how many epidurals I've done in my career, and I've kind of lost count, but using a bit of logbook type and frequency calculation, I reckon it's somewhere around 6,000.
Wow.
And I still think it's just such a fantastic procedure. I really love it.
Yeah. I think also it's interesting how it's also almost the great leveller. It's anyone can fail and anyone can succeed in epidural, and that's part of the challenge. You can shop around quite a lot and actually see how many different people use how many different techniques. I've changed my practice multiple times. But I think it's part of the challenge of learning, and also part of the challenge of supervising as well.
Absolutely, and I think there's challenge on both sides, and that certainly for learning, I always say to people when I'm trying to correct their technique, if you don't like it, then just smile sweetly at this point and then do whatever you like when I'm out of the room. And the thing when you get more senior is your challenge goes from performing the procedure to teaching others how to perform the procedure, which is just as much of a challenge. How far do you let somebody go before you take over? How do you make them feel positive and good about what they're doing rather than making them feel like failure? And these sort of things can make the difference between it being a psychologically crushing failure or a takeover of, you needed some help, but actually you did good and these are your tips for next time it happens.
And do you think that can actually impact someone on their overall view of their obstetric placement? Do you think it's that approach to the procedural learning?
It's certainly a part of it. Mm. And it's about if you have a few negative experiences at the start of your obstetric block, then it becomes very difficult to rescue that, as it were. Whereas if you have positive experiences and you get comfortable, then it's much nicer.
I guess that brings us on actually to people's experience on it, is that something before I started OBS was some trainees will say, oh, this is going to be fantastic for you. And some are like, get out as quick as you can. Oh, so glad with my OBS placement ended. I sort of have some ideas, but why do you think obstetric is so marmite for various anaesthetists who come into it?
It's quite interesting, isn't it? There seems to be a divide of anaesthetists who like ICU and anaesthetists who like obstetrics. And generally, the ones that like obstetrics don't like ICU and vice versa. I'm in a weird situation that I'm in the middle and kind of like both. And during COVID, I became an ICU consultant and I really enjoyed it. Not necessarily the COVID.
The work, not necessarily the time and the context.
Yeah, exactly. I've kind of tried to work out what it is. And I think it's something to do with whether you like, is it to do with whether you like control or whether you're happy to be of service? And I know you do get some control in obstetrics, but actually, if you think about it, not that much. When somebody wants an epidural, they want an epidural. There's not much you can do about it. And cesarean sections, yes, we're involved in the decision making and all of that. But if someone needs a cesarean section, they need a cesarean section, whether you want them to need a cesarean section or not.
Yeah.
Which I'm quite happy with. It's absolutely fine. And it's kind of a procedural and non-technical discipline.
Interesting what you said about structure versus, let's call it flow, maybe?
Yeah.
Because ICU, as you say, the day has a plan. Rarely will the entire plan get completely derailed for more than one member of the team who will maybe have to sit next to a person syringing in blood if something's going horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Sorry, that happened to me the other day. Whereas obstetrics is very much, here is the plan, very easily at 8:01, that plan can completely be torn to shreds and then you're just kind of almost whack-a-moling things as it comes. Ideally, you shouldn't be whack-a-moling, you should be seeing things and solving them as you go, which we'll talk about. But
they're called patient sunken?
No, I'm referring to the problems of the day, the tasks of the day, not the patients. I am not one who goes around with a rubber mallet whacking patients on the head and saying that's anaesthesia. I think that's a... Yeah, you know, I would just lose my GMC number very quickly if I did that.
That would be bad. There'd be forms to fill in.
Yeah, there'd be too many forms. It would cause too many headaches.
Do you have any other memories of your IA, COA, as it was back then?
Not so much of UCL, but as a junior registrar, I did my first year at the Homerton Hospital in Hackney, and very busy obstetric unit there. It was a lot of fun, back-to-back sections, epidurals, etc., etc., including some weird and wonderful stuff because, you know, Hackney has a very diverse population, and we had some very interesting things that happened. And again, this thing, which I like not necessarily knowing what the day is going to throw at me and being surprised. It suits my personality, and I'm quite happy to be thrown one thing from one direction and having to deal with another thing in another direction. And obstetrics has that. I think that made it always something that I was interested in. In my day, and this is going to sound like granddad talking to the kids, isn't it? We didn't have SIAs in my day. Mm. And so you basically became an anaesthetist and you could choose to go into ICU, you could choose to go into obstetrics, you didn't have to justify your specialty. And I wonder if there's something in there that we may need to make the pendulum swing back a little bit, because I became an obstetric anaesthetist, I suppose, as a consultant rather than as a registrar, although I did plenty of obstetrics as a registrar. Gained the specialist skills a little bit later, and that was fine. And so there's a little bit of serendipity that happens all the way through your career, and you just take on something and run along with it. I didn't have obstetrics in my job plan when I started as a consultant, but that kind of morphed through various reasons. And now it is in my job plan, and I love it. Just because you do an SIA or, you know, you have a specialist interest when you become a consultant, there's no reason why you can't pick up the skills necessary to take something else on during your consultant career. Mm. And, for instance, I did that with bariatrics. One of the things that I kind of find a little bit difficult with the specialist training and the way that we do the specialist training units is how fixed we are on doing blocks. And I don't mean regional anaesthesia blocks. I mean a chunk of that particular training. Like if you're not doing 3 months of purely obstetrics, then it doesn't count as a training thing. And I love obstetrics, but I wouldn't want to do it every day in my job plan, thank you very much. It would just become too much. And maybe that's what puts some people off obstetrics as well. They just get an overdose of it for the time during their training.
Yeah, as much as it's fun to have no 2 days are the same, if you know 2 days are the same for 3 months at a time, you're absolutely kind of burning the candle at both ends.
I love the fact that some of my days are the same.
With training and going to consultancy, how do you think an obstetric anaesthetist or an anaesthetist who does obstetrics, how do you think they are special, if special is the right word.
Obstetric anaesthetists and anaesthetists that do obstetrics. Is there a difference? I don't think so. We need to remember that a lot of the skills that we gain during our training are transferable. All the communication skills, a lot of the procedural skills, you know, the fact that you can do a spinal and an epidural, it's about experience and being used to the protocols and the procedures and the environment and the people in that environment.
I find that particularly doing that as a junior registrar or sort of CT3, it's actually a good time to hone and perfect those skills. And I actually found that a lot of those skills I got improved quite dramatically in obstetrics, and then I applied them elsewhere.
Yeah.
So particularly going to emergencies, since doing quite a lot of obstetrics, we are expected to be the island of calm in emergencies a lot. And I found that actually nothing will make you practice your poker face and also calming the room than people bursting through the door for a Cat 1 section, everyone running around. This doesn't happen, obviously, listeners, because it's a good time to say, everyone stop. Are you okay? Let's do this. Let's protocolize this. Delegate. How many people are in the room? You can leave. Things like that. Actually, that skill, then turning up to emergencies on the ward or running to A&E recess to deal with a difficult airway, you can fall back into almost sort of a cruise control to sort that out, and then it's the procedural stuff will come afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of techniques that you can use to calm the room down, and those are definitely some of them. And something that I very much believe in is using kind of the tone of your voice. And most people, when they start to get stressed, they start to put their voice up and the pitch of their voice starts going up. Don't worry, everything is fine.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to believe you. Whereas if you say, don't worry, everything is fine, you slow your voice down, you take the tone of and the pitch of your voice down, and then people actually stop and listen to you, and it changes the mood of the room, and it allows people to focus in much more on what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mediplus has been working alongside anaesthetists for over 20 years, creating innovative devices you use every day. Focus on your patients, knowing you have reliable equipment by your side. Our market-leading dedicated Teva sets inspire confidence so you can concentrate on what matters most. Don't take our word for it. Talk to your colleagues and discover the Mediplus difference. Visit us at www.mediplusuk.com to learn more.
When we're talking about communication, I feel that is actually what makes obstetric anaesthetists special. And when you are completing your IAC, those who are finding it Marmite should be looking to improve is their ability to control a room in chaos, really. And you see this person on the E-list doing non-obstetric emergencies, taking it in their stride when something is not going correct with an airway, because they have got these amazing skills at dealing with emergencies with a whole room full of people. The other thing I think that makes them quite special is their ability to have almost an unlimited patience when it comes to training people. And I think that is a really rich environment to be a part of. I think it's due to the amount of people who come in needing to learn a set amount of skills.
I think this brings us back to the point that we were making about transferable skills, and that's about transferable skills that you learn in the labour ward. The training thing, particularly when you're training on an awake patient, and also your communication and managing a room when you have your customer there and awake and who knows perfectly well what's going on. And I think one bit of advice that I was going to give is, I know I said everything is fine earlier, but actually if something's not fine, don't pretend everything's fine. Your customer is perfectly aware that everything is not fine, and just be honest with them and say, okay, this is going on. We're here doing this. This is what's going to happen next. Have you got any questions? And bring the patient with you, and your patient will love you for it.
Absolutely. I remember dealing with my first major obstetric hemorrhage, having not done obs for 15 months, and then it was my third session back. And just actually saying to them, so this is what's happening. There's quite a lot of bleeding. What's reassuring is you're talking to me. I'm talking to you. That's all good. I'm going to tell you everything that's happening. There's going to be a few people coming in the room. There's going to be some loud bleeps. I want you to keep talking to me while I'm doing stuff. And actually, everything went fine, which is good. But the next day, one of my colleagues went to see them, and they were like emphatically thankful to me, and my colleague passed it on, which is actually a really nice thing that you get far more in obstetrics than with anaesthesia in theatres, I find.
Absolutely, because your patient is unconscious when you're doing all these great things in the operating theatre, usually.
Yeah. Exactly. I wanted to go from... We mentioned about sort of being in the island of calm in the potential storm of stress. How else do you think that anaesthetists on labour ward keep the place safe or keep their patients safe?
Again, it's the non-technical thing, but also knowledge. And so we have knowledge and experience, and we're absolutely vital to the safety of the labour ward and to the vigilance of a place where something can happen at any moment. And we need to be ready to throw our plans out of the window and do something completely different. And I think that's where a lot of the anaesthesia safety comes in. Also the handovers, you know. Mm. We have a different perspective on some things, and we will be able to predict some things better than other people in the labour ward team. So having us in the handovers and discussing with the obstetricians, often on some of the medical issues as well. You know, we have a lot of medical knowledge. Many of us have done medical jobs. There's a lot of medicine in our exams, and possibly more than in some of the obstetric exams. So when something slightly weird comes in, then we've got other skills that we can add.
Interesting what you said about we are another safety mechanism. Going into a room, having a look at things, people will have done a year of anaesthetics by this point, and you not only are just being a doctor in general, you develop that end of the bedogram and it's applying it to a different environment. But definitely there's a reason you have a gut feeling about things. It's pattern recognition. It's something's not right here. Hang on a sec. Ask questions. If in doubt, you know, you escalate it. And that's why communication with the rest of the team is really important. And if you develop that relationship early and the kind of flagging things up, then people will flag things to you early, and it'll make your job a lot easier, sort of dealing with problems before they even become problems.
Yeah, and then you pick up the uterine rupture earlier, or, you know, whatever else is going on.
Exactly. And then also it helps you sort of say, you know, coordinate your team as well. And also if you're in your novice period and still finding your feet with that, escalating to the senior with saying, look, it's multifaceted, isn't it? It's like you said, we're not just proceduralists, even though that is a big facet of the novice period, is learning to do those procedures. It's the wider view, the softer skills, the technical skills, which you then... you can transfer in from your theatre and ICU experience, and you can transfer out from your obstetric experience after.
Mm. And it's the relationship that we have with the obstetricians and the midwives. And, you know, when I do my labour ward session, I get on really well with the consultant obstetricians. Yeah. And, you know, I'm lucky with the people that I regularly have there. Actually, all of the ones in my unit are really lovely.
Yeah.
And we rely on each other for our second opinions and things like that.
And I think also as in doing your obstetric blocks, it's one of the places where you actually work with the same people the most who aren't within your specialty.
Yeah.
For example, as a trainee, you know, you're doing a different list every day, potentially with a different consultant. You're having to do things differently, do different procedures and focus on, okay, what have I got to do for this? What surgery have I got to prepare for? Whereas in obstetrics, you end up working with the same people relatively regularly and sometimes out of hours. So you know, you can very quickly develop a team dynamic and know, okay, I'm on with this person. This is how we work together. Oh, okay, I'm on with this person. This is how we work. And then you can adjust it. And again, apply that back to when you're having to do a different list each day, or when you're suddenly doing, you know, a solo list with a mentor next door for the first time and establish those relationships which work well, particularly under pressure.
Yeah.
We've mentioned a couple of times about the Marmite effects of obstetric anaesthesia. What would you say to people who don't like obstetric anaesthesia if they're... I think you have to be aware about the influence that you can have on people as more of a senior trainee when they walk in and go, oh, you're not going to enjoy this rotation. What would you say to them?
It's quite interesting because I had this conversation with somebody quite recently, and one of the registrars was quite honest about the fact that he found the labour ward stressful. Some of it was a personal thing, the experiences of a labour ward before as a partner, and some of it was some of the heightened emotions that are attached to everything, and the heightened stakes, I suppose, when you've got not just one life, but you've got two lives to think about. Some people just aren't going to like that, and it's probably okay not to like it. Yes, we all have to do it. And I suppose then it's finding the positives that make it tolerable. If you absolutely hate it, then try and find something positive in there. And also, you might find that if you come in with, you know, you may have this attitude in the back of your head, but if you present a more positive front, then people will treat you more positively, and then the experience becomes better, not necessarily fully better. And just think about the way you appear to other people, particularly the midwives and the obstetricians.
Yeah.
And think about how you can change that and flip it to a more positive, open and honest appearance. Or just be honest with them and say, I find the atmosphere on labour ward uncomfortable. It's nothing to do with you. If I come across as negative, then please just let me know and I will try and amend it. Who knows, that might crack it a little bit.
It's interesting, having recently completed some antenatal classes, that you forget, working in healthcare, that most people's first interaction with healthcare is on the labour ward. And that is it's a very complex environment and quite a challenging environment to remain calm in if you're not used to it.
And particularly, I think, for the partner.
Yes.
And there's also the added kind of feelings of helplessness. And I sometimes talk about that to my trainees. Always involve the partner. Make sure that you know their name. Don't call them dad. Just call them by their name. Obviously, establish beforehand that they're happy to be what they want to be called, etc. Yeah. And always, one of my first things that I say is, what do you want me to call you? Remember their name. Bring them in. I have this thing with a partner where I say to them beforehand, this is my safety briefing for the cesarean section. If you feel faint, do not fight it. Do not try and ignore it. Just sidle back against the wall, slide down, put your head between your knees and stay there for twice as long as you think you need to. And now that I've said that, you'll be absolutely fine.
I like that, the safety briefing. So it's like pre-flight safety. Yeah, pay attention, as your safety briefing maybe not the same as you've had before.
I might steal that, because currently I just tell people that my dad's fainted at all three of his children's births. So that sounds a bit nicer than that.
I call it sitting on the naughty step, which is, I don't know where I've got that from, but I should probably rephrase that.
I quite like having it as a positive thing, and also about the fact that you've approached the elephant in the room of them going, oh my goodness, what happens if I faint? You know, I'll be a bad husband and I'll be a bad father or mother, you know, whoever, and I won't be able to do for my partner what I want to be doing. So there's all these sort of weird things going around in the partner's heads. And also then at the end saying something positive, like, now that I've said that, it's not going to happen. Then you've programmed them into it not happening. Bring them in, help them to bond with their child who's just been born.
Yeah.
And try and allay some of the anxiety and some of the feelings of helplessness. So you're in a situation here where you're watching your loved one who might be in pain, who might be having something scary done, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. I think
I hope that's not too unreassuring for your experience that's coming up.
No, well, to be honest, I'm just... No, I think it's...
I think the Ops Emergencies episode will be more unreassuring.
No, to be honest, I think restarting on labour ward on calls and the build-up is going to be interesting. But no, it's fine. It's very odd considering there's a lot of insight, particularly the antenatal class. I ended up rumbling myself as an anaesthetist in the second session, partly because I was disinhibited from fortnight shifts in a row, but also partly because they were asking very tricky, specific questions about epidurals.
Because they were trying to rumble you as an anaesthetist.
Potentially. I set myself up.
They saw a mole.
It is interesting, because even if I was not an anaesthetist but still medical, you forget that it's a completely different environment. Unless you're an anaesthetist, an obstetrician or gynae trainee, or someone who's rotated within it recently, it's completely different. You can have that danger of sort of feeling like you know things, but not actually knowing much at all.
Exactly.
In a way, I'm in a quite lucky position.
On the VIP effect, you'll get all sorts of people coming through. And I remember being left with a consultant gastroenterologist when I was an SHO, having the section. And I kind of thought that my consultant was going to do it, but it just ended up being me. And just treat them like everybody else and be honest with them like everybody else. I think when doctors get bad care, it's when the doctors that are looking after them think that somebody else should be doing the thing that they would normally do.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid to do the thing that you'd normally do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I actually treat all my patients as VIPs holders, so I wouldn't know the difference.
Top tips for surviving obstetric on calls.
They're a different beast.
They are a different beast. Yeah, and I was thinking about this, and some of it is kind of obvious thing. It's about epidurals.
Okay.
I'm going to give one technical tip. Rather than going in with your tooey needle perpendicular to the back and to the skin, why not angle it upwards just a little bit? Because if you've got an angle upwards, it's much easier to thread your catheter. And you're not having to kind of poke it round 90 degrees. You're much more at about 50 to 60 degrees if you've got it angled upwards. I recently did a spinal on somebody with an incredible scoliosis, and the angle on her was downwards and to the right, and that's where I got the CSF. Yeah.
Oh, crikey.
But she was about 86 years old.
Yeah.
Having a baby?
No. And one of the reasons, you know, why it's not just a procedure that anyone can do is that we need to know the anatomy. Just simple knowledge of the anatomy, the structures that your tooey needle is reaching, is really important. And that makes it much easier to direct it in the right place. When your epidural's working, if you've got a unilateral epidural, recite it, particularly if it's in the early stages. Never take a dodgy epidural to theatre. Don't even bother, if it's unilateral, don't even bother trying to top it up, just do a spinal.
And that's why one of our things is why the obstetric ward rounds, because we went into anaesthesia to get out ward rounds, right? But the obstetric ward rounds are pretty important, because you should, when you're taking over the care of 12 ladies in labour, check to make sure these are working. Would you take it to theatre or would you bin it?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're going to bin it early. And the way I usually explain it to the patient who may not particularly want to have their epidural recited is that I want them to have a really good birth experience. And at the moment, we're not providing it. We're providing an okay one. But I've got a chance to make your birth experience really great by fixing this epidural.
That's a very nice phrase. I think I'm going to steal that.
I should copyright this, shouldn't I?
We're stealing it. 3 months before release, you've got a bit of time to copyright it. So let's say you've got 10 ladies in labour and there's a lot of things going on. Do you have any top tips for communication with the wider MDT during your on-calls to help things run smoother?
I think it's just about anticipating and planning, making sure that you know everybody's names. I quite like doing a round of introductions at handover because, you know, there's always people whose names you don't know.
I have to write those down if I'm on this onto my handover sheet. Otherwise, I have to ask about five times.
No, yeah, but if you do it for every handover, then it actually gets imprinted in your memory by about the third or fourth time.
Yeah.
And then for the rest of your obstetric block, you're absolutely swimming and everyone loves you because you remember their names.
Yeah. I think also particularly the coordinating midwife.
Yeah.
Because they're the person who has the overall oversight of the whole labour ward. So it can be quite challenging when it's 4 a.m, you're doing your fourth section of the night and you're still getting bleeped by people who you think would know that you're in theatre and you haven't left theatre. Mm. So talking to the midwife to say, look, could you just make people aware? And they can talk to the rest of the team and say, if you need an anaesthetist, you can contact them, but ideally go through me so I can get the lay of the land. We can call for help if we need things like that. It can try your patience sometimes.
I think that's a very good tip. They're the person who knows what is going on, who's coming down from antenatal. And every time I reset from doing a task like an epidural, I come out and say, what's next to the midwife in charge?
Mm.
Helps with that.
It's a great tip, actually. Yeah.
And you can really learn a lot from them about seeing things coming down the road. For example, looking at the maternity whiteboard, looking at the CTGs and saying, okay, is there something funny happening with this one? Yeah, it's not the best, but I think, you know, the team are going in shortly. Okay, so I need to be ready for this. I'm going to go quickly have a water break or something in order to get ready in case we need to go to theatre. And then also sort of almost try and plan what you can.
Hmm.
I think it's quite an important thing to do.
I've got one more tip.
Oh, yeah?
Don't overfast your patients. So if you've got cesarean sections backed up, allow them to drink clear fluid.
Yeah.
Sips or sends.
Absolutely. If you read the 2011 guidelines, so you know, this isn't new. This is like, 13 years old now. Although the guidelines say 2 hours for clear fluid, there's the blurb at the bottom of the guidelines says that all the evidence points to the fact that about 10 to 20 minutes, your glass of water is completely absorbed from your stomach and the pH of your gastric secretions is less acidic. So you could argue that it's actually safer to allow them to drink clear fluid than it is not. And think about the poor women who are there nil by mouth because there's the chance they might have a section.
Yeah. It's pretty bleak.
It's pretty awful. Yeah.
I mean, you're in pain, potentially, you're uncomfortable, you're knackered, and you're also you know, dying to have a sip of water.
Yeah,
you know?
We should not be dehydrating our patients before the cesarean section.
And it would just make them feel more sick as well.
Mm. Exactly. It does.
So moving on from our top tips for surviving on calls, we've got to think about the career path of an obstetric anaesthetist. Do you have any advice for people who've just finished their IA, COA, on what skills and knowledge they should be looking to improve?
Well, obviously all the skills and knowledge that you have of obstetrics, but the way I want to encourage people to improve them is to engage, I'm obviously going to say this because I'm Vice President of the Royal College of Anaesthetists, to engage with our educational institutions like the Royal College, like the Obstetric Anaesthetist Association. There's a wealth of resources there. And also, you know, why not put together a poster of your quality improvement project and get involved that way? And that gives you an early head start. Also, as a part of it, improves your knowledge and your evidential knowledge vastly by taking part in these things.
I also think that for the ST4 applications, there's quite a bit of an achievement barrier sometimes for people. However, usually the obstetric lead will be looking to enter some form of poster into the Obstetric Anaesthetist Association conference, which is actually a very good international conference.
But yeah. I think also there's a lot of room for if you're interested in education in obstetrics, in obstetric anaesthesia, because it's not just anaesthetist. It's an absolute well of resources and opportunity to
simulation,
multidisciplinary team meetings.
Prompt training sessions are something they're always screaming at for faculty.
Yeah.
And it's something that would be great to get involved with.
Moving on further than that, sort of a more general thing, where do you see the future of obstetric anaesthesia? Whether it's where it's going or some challenges it's going to face?
There's a lot of things coming up that are going to change the way we work. For instance, artificial intelligence. I'm not sure it's going to change our job very much in obstetric anaesthesia, except for decision support, which will be quite interesting. And maybe some of the high-risk clinics will have a lot more decision support from AI than they used to in the past. So I think there's something there that's coming up, which both fascinated and excited for, but also a little bit scared by. Because of the change that it's going to have on our general way of working. Where else? I think the labour ward will be broadly similar. Generally, we mentioned this before we started talking, might as well just say it now, there's lots of talk about medical associate professionals, and personally I believe that doctors are the people with not just the practical skills, but with the decision-making skills for those practical skills. Mm. We can teach anyone. I can teach a 16-year-old to put an epidural in, but they don't have the anatomical knowledge, they don't have the experiential knowledge of making the decisions about when to do an epidural, when not, etc., etc. And I don't think we can divorce the pure technical skill from the knowledge that is needed to treat the patient. And so for these procedures, I think we make a mistake if we remove the highly trained decision-making doctor from the front line. And we should absolutely be on the front line with direct access to our patients for all of these procedures. I don't think we're going to see anaesthetists or anaesthesiologists or whatever we decide to call ourselves taking a backstage on the labour ward. I think we're very much still on the front stage, and on the front stage both in the decision making and the practical procedures performance. So hopefully that will stay.
Yeah.
And I hope so, because I do love it. And there's something just so human about the labour ward that I can't see it becoming determined by artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's...
Do you know what I mean?
It's definitely one of the most important places in a hospital to have a friendly face and someone reassuring and personable. If you're coming in being trying to be very blunt, robotic, factual, you're not going to build a rapport. You're going to escalate stress levels, going to make the whole experience worse for everyone involved.
Yeah.
So I think, like you said, how would a robot... AI come into that? It's quite tricky.
Yeah, I mean, birth is such a human thing. It's, it's probably the most human thing that there is, the creation of new life.
You just can't dehumanize it.
Yeah.
Part of what you said there, the role of the obstetric anaesthetist being on the front line is so important due to the safety profile that we've actually managed to achieve with Observe Anaesthetics. I remember the address that was given to us at Diplomats Day by Dr. Watson about the history of Observe Anaesthetics and that people had RSIs in their living room. And you think, oh my God, how we've got here is due to a combination of so much work into making birth as safe as it can be that you've got to advocate for moving forwards with people who are able to advocate for very complex situations whilst having a multitude of different stresses on them. Prime example was when you get told in a CAP 1 with a query AFE where other people are looking at the fetal bradycardia and telling you to do an RSI, but you would make that mother and baby pass away by delivering it. And it's through years and years of training that you've got there, really. And I think that's good to hear that how important it is for people to be on the front line.
Yeah.
I think it's the nature of something which is a wonderful thing, and it can be very much sort of almost elective in nature, and it can at any moment flip to one of the most time-critical emergencies you will come across in anaesthesia.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and if you have a proper CAT 1 section, I think the only thing that gets people as stressed as that is a truly, truly difficult airway or can't intubate, can't oxygenate.
And, you know, as you said, an elective section that's going beautifully can then just turn. There can be a surgical complication intraoperatively or even through nobody's fault. The uterus isn't contracting.
Yeah.
And it turns from being an entirely normal, boring elective kind of thing, boring in inverted commas, yeah. You know, there's always the playlist, to a real emergency.
Yeah.
And you just can't categorize that and take the people who can make those decisions away from that sort of situation.
Yeah. And that's what we train for as anaesthetists,
exactly.
Isn't it? It's, you know, you plan for everything to go electively and smoothly, but ultimately you have a skill set which can be applied the instant things go wrong and get it back on that path.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the outro. A big thank you to Helgi for his time and for his good humour in covering a wide range of topics which hopefully have given you some top tips for life after the IACOA. As ever, please do leave feedback. There is a link on the website, and we will also leave the link in bio of the website to the OAA, where you can have a look for events and for further education opportunities. That brings us on to our next episode, which will be the last in this current mini-series. It's probably going to be one of our most important yet. It will be with Dr. Esther Godfrey from the Support Project, which is a huge project in Wales, looking at how we as anaesthetists and other allied health professionals communicate with parents during neonatal resuscitation. Esther is a fantastic speaker. We'll talk about her own experience and that of the learnings from the project. It has changed my practice, how I interact with the parents, and I really would recommend a listen. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.